know, go to jail. And I said, well, I think I'll quit. But nonetheless, I got to see a lot of different things. And there was a particular group of guys that were in Colorado Springs in Colorado, at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And they had an affiliation with the U.S. military. You know, the Air Force is basically based there, right? Yeah. NORAD is right there. The mountain, yes. It's in Colorado Springs. So a lot of our military structure is sitting in Colorado Springs. So they did a lot of work with the military. So there was this group of, you know, super geniuses that were working on artificial intelligence, and I knew them really well because I had bought some technology from them. So, you know, I was having a conversation with this guy one time, and this is about 1983, 84. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he said, the problem is heat. He said, in the current configuration that we have for chips, the information still, the electrical impulse in which these information, it still goes back and forth horizontally across a substrate. Now, the substrate can be silicon, it can be gallium arsenide, it can be a lot of different things, but the fact that it still has to sort of run back and forth is what causes, it generates heat. Yeah. And heat causes the information to, I mean, you know what heat does to information, yeah. It basically stops it, right? So he said, our problem is heat. He said, if we could get past the heat problem, then we, you know, we'd be all right.
Which they have been doing with these much lower, what's the phrase? But they've done a lot on the cooling, and there's something what they call a lower output. I don't know quite how it is. They managed to attain the same speed on a much
they have
more calmer.
Superconductive materials that they were trying or whatever. They were even trying biological because they figured, listen, the brain could, you know, if we could replicate the brain, and the brain accesses vertically, it doesn't access horizontally. So if they could replicate the brain structure and they could have some sort of biological memory and they could go vertically, then, you know, this would solve the problem. But they did solve the problem. They solved the problem in an absolutely amazing way. Some bright spark, some genius in the Pentagon realized that the U.S. military has literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of smart equipment. They have vehicles and weapons systems, and they're all smart. They all have computer technology, right?
Yeah.
So they figured if they could, in your heart, you know, you have these pacemaker cells, right?
Yes.
And your entire heart is made up of pacemaker cells. And the reason that is because if part of the heart gets damaged, the pacemaker cells can relocate to another part of the heart and keep going, right? Yeah. So literally any part of the heart could be the brain, quote unquote, of the heart, right?
Right, so they're using the whole computer network to host.
Exactly, and it doesn't have the heat problem.
Yeah.
They take a central brain that is sort of running the whole system, and that brain allocates information processing to different remote.
That's kind of like the Linux principle. You know, there's some multiple sources of people working in something. You use all the networks. So even when your computer isn't being used, when you could rent out your processing power to do certain calculations.
Exactly.
And then, yeah.
The Internet of Things.
The
right?
Internet of Things, absolutely.
So this whole sort of Internet of Things thing is what triggered this thought process in the Pentagon. And they went, geez, this is amazing. Let's try this. And it worked.
This was Jade Helm.
That's what Jade Helm really was.
And how's the report of how it all went? Do we? I mean, I'm sure they won't disclose that.
It's a classified report. But you know, I haven't read the report, but I've heard people talk about the report. And I think it went pretty amazingly well. It went scarily well, which is what the problem is. I mean, if you are trained in military planning. You know, a battle plan is a thick document. It's a super thick document. And part of that thick document involves all kinds of war gaming and all these things to come up with alternative methods and whatever. And there's literally thousands of component parts that have to be thought through. You know, it's not
so
just a matter of...
So are we saying even the general is being replaced?
100%. They can do a war plan. What would take a group of guys, highly trained guys, a week to do... The Jade system can do in minutes.
Yeah.
In minutes.
But where does that leave us with the currency reset? So we've got AI everywhere. We've got the AI 100%. Running the military.
So let's go back to that idea of capital. There's no requirement for capital.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at American companies as a whole, they're sitting on $1.4 trillion in cash. Apple sits on $207 billion. Now, that can only be if there's been a radical change in the way that economy always worked, because in the history of mankind, in the history of, let's say, the 20th century of capital, companies needed to retool. They needed to spend money. They needed, so there was never any companies that sat on huge amounts of money because they needed to, I mean, General Motors had to retool. Yeah. I mean, you know, this was the old industrial state, right? But yeah. The new industrial state is one where it's all driving towards this marginal cost line. There's no real capital cost to production. So what's happening? They're building up cash reserves. They're building up cash reserves. They're building up cash reserves. So if you're in the capital business, if you're Citibank, and your previous business was built on being an intermediary, and this intermediary business is starting to like die because who needs you? Right? Yeah. I mean, they're all.
So the megacorps, what I call sometimes the corporatocracy, the people that don't even do the production, they get it outsourced to China, et cetera, and they just do the designs. They get the ARM chip that is also just a design, really. They get someone else to manufacture it, and they pull together an iPad or an iPhone real cheap if we are with the Apple. In terms of cost to them, they don't need the manufacturer, the factory, the cost. That's all being done at a layer below them. They are just becoming uber profitable and are sitting on exceptional amounts of capital, I suppose, is your key point. And
even the guys below them, the guys who are normally the users of capital, their capital requirements are tremendously diminished because you can produce this product. You can 3D print. And give it a couple of years, and you're going to be...
So it's not just globalization and low labor costs in India and China.
No.
It's about the technological elements of it.
Technology.
So what's happening is we're getting a... But for the people who are the 99%, they don't feel overweighed with this capital and these bulging bank accounts.
No, they don't.
It's the 1%. So this is the hollowing out of the middle classes, I suppose, and also at a corporate level, the mega corps, as I call them, and the tech, the super techs, are just streaming ahead. And there's this almost stretching out of, you know, this income and capital continuum. How does this play out, and why the reset, though?
Well, let's talk that through. Because what you see happening, when there's no demand for capital in the world, and you see labor being replaced with technology, you are going to end up with higher unemployment. You're going to end up with money flow that's coming from the central banks. It's coming from the governments to try to kickstart an economy where the entire segments of the economy have been wiped out. There's nothing to replace them yet.
Yeah.
So labor is not being replaced with, you know, you don't fire 65,000 workers and they go to McDonald's. McDonald's is hiring robots. I mean, there's articles about it every day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. McDonald's and also prepay stations. You won't even pay a person soon.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
labor's getting
wiped out. Small business is getting wiped out to a great extent because they just don't have the ability to, they don't have the economy of scales to do all these massive things. And yet the government is using a 50-year-old Keynesian mindset that turns around and says, okay, let's just pump money into the system and we're going to borrow it because we can borrow it at nothing. We can borrow it at zero. So let's just pump money and pump money and pump money. Where does the money go? The money goes to banks. The money goes to financial intermediaries. It always has.
Yeah.
But in the past, those financial intermediaries did their jobs and they would loan money to corporations or whatever who were creating jobs, right? So what do they do with the money? I mean, what do we see? We see in 20 years a derivative market that went from, you know, $500 million a year to any, you know, I've seen numbers as high as, you know, $1.8 quadrillion, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like somebody who, you know, if you keep giving somebody, you know, free tacos, you're going to look out in their backyard and you're going to see piles of tacos because they can't possibly eat it all.
Yeah.
So this system is old. This system is outdated. This system is being eclipsed.
But apart from the age, it's the mathematical fact that we can't ever have normal interest rates again. I mean, we also had, we've agreed and we come to this conclusion separately, but we spoke on it, that I think you did some maths even against...
Yeah, I did a model on it.
Yeah, but we just can't go to a normal interest rate because against the revenues government get in, The interest servicing bill would be too vast. So is it not a case of, well, it's good that we have a better idea or a new idea, because this idea is actually out. It can't play. It's monetary policy is completely broken because of where we've gone with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more than broken. It's completely obsolete, and it needs to be replaced with something. And the problems that we see, to answer your question more directly, the problems that we see are really evidence of a transition. I mean, in the past, when we went from water to steam, from steam to petrol-based technology, we did suffer downtrends. I mean, you know, when there was a transition from each industrial revolution to the next, economies collapsed. We've seen more than one collapse in time. But none of those were paradigmatic shifts. Each and every one of those was really just sort of a step, a higher step of the same thing, right? It was the same capital requirements. It was the same. Everything worked pretty much the same. So let me ask you a really interesting question. We have money, and money is, you know, money, we define money as a store of wealth, right? And currency is something that reflects money. So we have this store.
Also, that key thing of a medium of exchange that we'll still need some 100%. Degree of. Yeah,
it's a medium of exchange. It's a store of wealth for a medium of exchange, right? Now, when prices of things go to zero, when I mean near zero. Okay, I'm not talking about zero. Okay, when I say zero,
in that mathematical sense.
When I say zero, I'm
never
saying,
quite you know, gets but, there, but
yeah, but it's going that way, right?
Yeah,
it becomes insignificant. When prices get to that point, we are going to have to redefine what value means, because we can't equate it in the same way. We're going to need a new definition for money. You know, we have this social economics that's starting to come on the scene. People are talking about social economics. Now, in the past, it was really easy to value things, because we would say, okay, a book is worth 20 minutes of my labor. And so, you know, the utility value to me was 20 minutes of my labor, so here we go, right? But now we're starting to have this new paradigm. The greatest example of this is probably Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin was a virtual world that was created that had money in it. And if you wanted to join that virtual world, if you wanted to be part of that society, you couldn't go get Bitcoins. You had to serve the community to get them. They called them miners. I'm sure you know. Yep. I'm just saying it for clarity. So they had these miners, sure. and the miner would go in and he would solve algorithmic problems, and his work would serve the community to validate transactions. And by serving the community, he got paid Bitcoin and he became part of the community, right?
Absolutely.
There was no design for outside influence of this. People could trade within that community, but it was all based on their service. So if a guy wanted to become rich in that environment, he had to provide more service to the community. Not to individuals in the community,
but that's never changed. I mean, if you want to make money in this world, the question has to be, how do I serve? I mean, Bill Gates, all these guys, they've provided operating systems for computers on everybody's desk. Whether you see them as serving or not, they've actually delivered service. So I don't think the virtual element has changed that, the reward for service.
Let me finish the thought, okay? The idea is that when marginal cost goes to zero, or went near zero, we may find that we redefine what value is. We might turn around and say that rather than me providing labor, which is kind of worthless because, you know, a machine or a computer could do it for me for free, instead of doing that, I plant a tree. And the society, the community, values that tree and says, okay, well, that's worth 6 units, and we see the book is worth 2 units, and that's your exchange rate. But that is fundamentally a redefinition of money, because it's the utility value of the money that's changing completely. We're creating a new paradigm for utility. So people right now, what we see happening, what we see investors doing, what you and I get the conversation and we have the questions all the time, what do I do, where do I go? And our response is always the same. Look, you got to go to hard assets, because hard assets are tangible. I mean, you know, if I own 25% of a company that produces whatever widgets, you know, I don't have to get a dividend in dollars or pounds or whatever. They can pay dividends in chickens, right? Mm. So these things have tangible value. I don't want to be holding paper assets that are valued based on a market that may or may not exist tomorrow. right?
Yeah.
That's not
manipulated immensely by the current central bank's behavior as well.
100%. But all of this is all of that activity is symptomatic of watching something. It's like watching a building burn, you know? I did a talk one day, and this guy that stood up before me was going on and on and on and on about the trajectory of the recovery. This is back in 2008. Okay, what's the trajectory of the recovery going to look like? What's the slope of the recovery going to look like? And I got up and I said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be insulting, but that's kind of like asking what the angle of descent was of the Titanic. You know, I mean, who cares? It's sinking. You know, yeah. It's going down. So yeah. Why would we spend time and energy trying to figure out what the angle of ascent or descent is? It's inevitable. This is a fundamental change. And the question that we should be asking ourselves is, how do we align ourselves to the future, which could be a year or 100 years, who knows, right? How do we align ourselves to the future, and how do we protect ourselves from the now, right? So I want to answer your question.
But beyond that, as many things go 10 to zero that can be automated and produced, etc., and we have a kind of second feel industrial revolution where things are mass produced really cheap, only there's no labor cost, manual labor, and it's all done. Surely at the same time as people become disproportionately wealthy because certain crops of things have gone real cheap, you will get other items that will go luxury that will become paranormally expensive. In some senses, we've already had that, you know, the Bugatti Veyron, €1 million. You know, there was never cars, even the best car never used to be so extreme. Now we're getting houses and cars and luxury items. As you have lower cost in your basic needs, yet you're a high net worth individual, don't we get a counterbalancing force? You don't just get zero cost on one side, because people who have resources are always going to channel them, always going to spend them. So all you get is super premium. I mean, over here, for example, a GT3 RS Porsche come out, really good rated car, selling for about an 80% premium on list price. You just can't get them. You have to pay almost for two to get one. And the same even for certain Ferraris. The F12 came out. You'll be pleased with this because it's from nearby home. I mean, that thing's selling a £375,000 car here in the UK, $200,000 premium. So you just get a surplus of money by those that have it to pursue the mega premiums as the other things go down.
My thesis is based on the fact that when you are producing at zero cost, then the Bugatti Veyron has no value other than maybe is an artistic value, because I can produce it for nothing. Which means there could be jillions of them. I have this group of guys that I meet with in Johannesburg that are, they're scientists, right?
But don't forget the materials used there. I mean, for example, silver in there, a lot of
this is the point. The point is that as technology increases, as we move down the technology line, right now we're talking about 3D printing. Now they have something called 4D printing. Have you heard of 4D printing?
No, I don't know where the fourth dimension comes in, actually. Let me tell you
what 4D printing is, because this is I'm going to go one step further after this. But 4D printing is they 3D print materials that are the materials are designed to, when you apply some sort of stimulus, that's usually hot water or something like that, when you apply a stimulus, it automatically conforms into a shape. Like you've seen metals that if you hit it, yes. You know, right? Okay. So it's sort of the same thing, but you 3D print the first component. So how this works is, let's say I'm building a car. I 3D print all the components, I stick it in a jig, and I hit it with hot water, and it automatically assembles itself. Right? Now, the next stage from that is something that Mercedes-Benz has done. You can look it up on the internet. You don't have to believe me, but Mercedes-Benz claims to have been able to grow a car. So they use some sort of organic crystalline structure or something, and they grew a car, and they show a picture of it, and they say, here's the car, and we grew it. This is how we manufactured this thing. So when you are moving in technology, remember the part of my premise was 1,000 times the advancements, right? When we are approaching a point in time, I mean, there was an article maybe a year ago where they say that the scientists claim to have been able to convert a photon of light into matter. Now, when I start converting light into matter, when I start being able to reconfigure materials, when I start being able to have a much more rapid and a much more efficient printing mechanism for production.
Okay, so everything can be, you can put in a seed cell almost anything that can be grown. So that's the fourth D element. But going back to the line that we're talking about, so let's assume Bugatti Veyrons, anything that's totally exclusive, eventually people will place value on something that is handmade in the same way that you get music people vinyl.
You hit it on the head. This is exactly what I'm saying. What's happened, though, at a fundamental level to accomplish what you just said, is that we redefined what value is.
Yeah.
Because, see, it's no longer the Bugatti Veyron. It's a beautiful thing. The car itself becomes worthless.
But yeah, if it's machine
visual,
made.
The creativity that came behind it, how it affects your bodily function when you see it, all of these things are what becomes valuable. But that is a fundamental redefinition of what value is.
Yeah. So the design and all the thinking and all the IP is not, rather than the tangibility is it. Yeah. And you get a highly efficient machine, but then it's not, it does the handmade thing that may even be slightly imperfect, which require human hands, the value then shifts to that.
100%.
Is what you're saying. 100%. But tie that all in to why we're going to have a reset.
Well, I think that the reset is twofold. Number one, the reset is inevitable. I think that the powers that be, the elite system, they recognize that this evolution is taking place with humankind. This evolution, we're going to call it a technology evolution. You know, our children, the brain function of our children, their brain chemistry is different to ours. They grew up reading, you know, using computers and using cell phones, and their brain chemistry is literally different than ours. So these guys are recognizing that this is happening. They can't stop it. It's going to take place. And so if you know that the ship is going to crash, isn't it better to have a controlled crash than a crash that just happens randomly? Isn't it better to scuttle the boat?
You're reminding me of that great book, Catch 22, which I'm almost assured that you read.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you remember our favorite character? I think we both had the favorite character, not Yossarian, but the guy who failed every mission and was actually kept ditching his plane. And he was practicing ditching his plane for eventually escaping the war.
100,000%.
Yeah.
So why would they scuttle the system? Well, they would scuttle the system because it's going to crash. It's burning. So it makes much more sense if you're looking
at the very people who scuttle it are the, unfortunately for us, are the same shadow of people that will introduce that which will be new. In other words, all we're going to do is get a reset, and we're going to the elites remain the same. They're just future generations, I assume, as they age. But
has it ever really changed?
No, Francis? I don't think it ever has.
I mean, we can go back in time immemorial.
Yeah,
and you're gonna have the same people, different people, but the same family names that go back thousands. It has never changed.
Yeah, and I don't see it changing because the solution will be theirs. And I don't believe they'll allow to let it go until they've already got a pretty good idea of exactly what next steps and what they'll roll out subsequently. As that solution. So what form, so bringing it to the people that are listening to this, and they're going to say, right, what do we do? When's it happening? And how do we position? The same questions you and I always ask. And what form will it take the new as well? So apart from positioning, understanding how our value systems start pre-aligning our value system so that we get the jump on everybody else who doesn't care to think and be forward-looking or futuristic nature.
Look, I mean, you know, as in all aspects of finance, I mean, we have to talk over time frames, right? I mean, over what time frame do we do this, or what time frame does this happen? If you look at the geopolitical situation in the world, it's pretty obvious that we're being pushed in a certain direction, right? I mean, the Soviet Union has the largest buildup of troops on its border since World War II, since the Nazis invaded. So whose troops are those? They're Western troops. Why are they there? Well, you tell me. Why is there this huge buildup of troops on the Soviet border? It's pretty clear to me that we are moving towards some climactic crescendo. You know, math just doesn't work. If I, ceteris paribus, all other things being equal, if I take
and,
the U.S.
And just to throw a hand grenade in that very topic, and it's slightly conspiratorial, but the Georgia Guidestones and the population numbers, do you place any store on that, and do you see this machination of war potential as part and parcel of that solution of bringing us down? So for those that don't remember, sorry to take another moment, Mark, the Georgia Guidestones, for those that aren't familiar, 500 million is the optimal population of the globe, is literally, I think, clause one or clause three the Georgia Guidestones, and no one knows exactly who owns that land, although you can guess at your heart's content. As a guideline principle. Sorry, carry on, Mark. So I wonder, just bringing that in with the buildup of troops and, you know, global conflict, etc.
It's if we look at the destruction of population. I mean, let's look at it this way. We're losing jobs, right? The people that are suffering the most are the people who do normal jobs, right?
Manual labor, particularly.
Yeah, machinists. I mean, you know, some skilled guys, but you know, I mean, you're talking about. Technology replaces certain things. It's not the creative people. It's not the people that are, you know, those are the people, they're not losing their jobs. The people that are losing their jobs are the people who actually do things, right? Because that can be replaced, right?
Yeah.
Well, you cannot, if you're the ruler of the world, you can't have a whole bunch of idle people around.
No. Devil makes work for idle hands, as they say.
100%.
Especially if you're the boss, you don't want them. So how are they going to neutralize 8.5 billion people?
Well, I think that there's probably a combination of several factors.
You know, I agree. There's no one.
No, I mean that's a lot of people to get rid of. You know, we were talking the other day about Zika. You know, Zika. If Zika became, you know, rampant, then people wouldn't have children. Nobody wants to have a child that has no brain, right? So you know, they won't have children. And in one generation, if you have one generation that doesn't have children, the population is diminished significantly, right? A war will take out a lot of people. A war also uses up a lot of old capital. You know, I mean, you've got trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars invested in these ships and planes. I mean, eventually you have to use that capital. If it's, you know, you either use it or it dies, right? You've got to replace it, right? And if I'm right, then this replacement process is going to be a difficult thing for the future, right? Technology is leapfrogging. It's leapfrogging. Things that we never thought as weapons before are weapons today. You know, so I mean, and the let me just say that the technology the United States has in terms of weapons would absolutely blow people's minds. People have no concept of what that country is capable of pulling out of its hat. If it
exactly.
ever really,
yeah, if anything really that goes public is something that's already two generations behind, is the golden rule.
Yeah. 15 or 20 years behind.
Yeah,
if you've heard of it, it's 15 to 20 years old.
That's right. I remember that with the lovely old Blackbird that we suddenly got to see. I mean, that was incredibly. It was well gone replaced, but it was a fabulous bit of machine. So, do you, just as a small curious side, this is for some of those that are interested. Do the hologram capability in the military that already existing? Yes or no?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, they've had holograms for a long time, since the 70s. They've had holograms. So, yeah, but they use it for different reasons. I mean, I can't really, you know, say all – it's not hard to figure out why you would use it. You know, I mean, in World War II, they used to have blow-up tanks.
Yes, like the inflatables.
Yeah, because –
So it's quite logical that you would continue to want something of that nature, just utilizing more modern technology.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, remember, everything in the world of military, everything in generally is iterative. You know, you go from one thing to the next thing to the next thing to the next thing, and you might be using, item number, you know, that's number 3 out of 300, right? In terms of, you know, it's output, you know, but the version that you're using, you know, you might be using version 3 as opposed to the version 300. You still have 300 in your arsenal, but why use it when I haven't used 3 yet? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So all of these things, but you know. Everything is evident of change. Everything is evident of change.
Why Russia, though, Mark? Why we got the troops build up on Russia? I mean, China's a big old place. They're trying to lay claim to the South China Sea, which is now looking like it's going to get a rebranded name to rid us of the word of China and the islands there. And the states are, you know, throwing their weight around a bit just down there. Why Russia?
It all depends on your agenda. You see, you can't. I don't want to. I can't really